Now being recorded.
Thank you, Tim. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRTPC call on the 10th of January 2012. On the call today, we have Zahid Jamil, James Bodell, Mikey O'Connor, Avery Doria, Barbara Knight, Kevin Erdman, Bob Mountain, Matt Serlin, and Jonathan Tenenbaum. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs and myself, Natalie Peregrine. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Eric Iriarty. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Natalie, and good morning, or afternoon or evening, everyone. This is the IRTPC Working Group call for January 10th, 2012. We have our agenda posted on the right-hand column of the Adobe chat screen, with one minor change, and that Avery will be joining us a little late and has asked that we move item number two, the detailed work plan, to the end or nearer to the end of our scheduled session. So I'd like to begin by asking if anyone, giving anyone the opportunity to raise their hand if they have any changes or updates to their statements of interest or foresee any immediate changes to those. Going once. Okay. With that, if you recall our meeting last Tuesday, we left off with a presentation from Bob Mountain and other members of the sub-team that were presenting use cases of domain name transfers that were done under the guise of a change of ownership function or change of control function. We got about halfway or perhaps two-fifths of the way through that presentation, so I wanted to allot about another 30 to 35 minutes for that, and we'll see where we are at the end of that at the end of that time frame. So if there are no other objections or items of business that we need to take care of beforehand, we'll go ahead and jump to item number three, and I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Mountain.
Thank you, James. This is Bob Mountain speaking. Marika, do I have control at this point of the presentation?
Yes, you do. Is there a section where you immediately want to jump to, a certain page? Because I can just take you there, and then you can take it from there.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, it is working now. Yeah, we're going to jump right away to slide 57. Okay. So again, thanks to the team for all their help in putting these things together. Since the last meeting, we went through and did, I think, a complete job of all the redactions, hiding personal information, as well as inserting a flowchart for most of the use cases. I think we have still have one to go, and that'll be done, you know, by today or tomorrow, and then we can post the final product, presuming that there are no further suggestions, comments, or otherwise from the group. The entire working group has been added to the Dropbox, and so you will have the ability to download. It's a fairly large attachment. I think it's 13 megabytes, which is why I use Dropbox. So if anyone hasn't looked at it, you should have access to the Dropbox, so feel free. Barbara had a question on the safety of Dropbox, and I personally have not heard of any issues with Dropbox. I don't know if you have to download the application, though. I think you can go to the Dropbox website and access it as well, although I generally use the app. So, but as far as that question goes, no, Barbara, I do not. I'm not aware of any safety issues that I've heard of with the Dropbox software. James, did you have a comment?
Well, just not really relevant to the safety, but more to the ICANN commitment to transparency. At a certain point, I presume it's our plan to perhaps move this over to the wiki or someplace where it's part of the ICANN archive. Just thinking, if we wanted to come back to this 5 years from now, would we be able to find it at Dropbox?
Yeah, I assumed at some point we would archive this in a ICANN official way. I'm just not familiar with what that process is, so I would defer to yourself, Marika, on that one.
Well, we'll burn that bridge when we get there, I guess.
Okay, great. Yep. Excellent. Okay, great. Well, if there are no other comments, then we move. So last time we finished use cases 1 and 2, which were an example of an inter-registrar transfer with the change of ownership and an intra-registrar with change of ownership. The first one was going from Dynadot to GoDaddy, And the second one was staying within GoDaddy but changing ownership. The next one, which was use case number three, was a domain going from Enom to Black Knight. Again, another example of an inter-registrar transfer with change of ownership, just with different registrars and obviously a different domain name. I believe Chris Chaplow, this was your use case. Am I correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, would you mind walking us through this one then?
Yes, certainly. Just thinking about the title of this, without wanting to make things complicated, it's actually an example of inter-register transfer via escrow with change of ownership on behalf of third party. So that's quite a mouthful. It actually is all went relatively simply compared to the last two we've seen. The only other thing is, unfortunately, this is only the information on one side of the fence. This is on the buyer's side of the fence, not on the seller's side. If you want to move to the next slide. The process flow, and onto the next one, I guess, yes. Here is the who is before the transfer took place, showing the registrar and the lock status on that client transfer prohibited. Next slide, please. Yes, this was, I think for some reason I couldn't get the whois off Enom, so this is the whois from Domain Tools, and it's showing the same information. Just notice in passing the status here is a different, phrasing, it's locked. That's the point we might want to just pick up later, which adds to the confusion for the non-initiated. Name servers as they were when they started. Next slide. Yeah, in this particular case, the sale had actually been agreed outside, had been agreed privately, but the buyer felt more secure if it was done through Sedo. So the domain was actually put into Sedo, and the Sedo transfer policy, system, was used. So we can see in there that the payment was made to Sedo. That's the highlight on the right hand side. And then a little bit later, the dates are on here if you can read them. So the sale was agreed on about the 12th. The payment was made on the 13th of November. December. The payment was received on the 16th. So this gives you an idea of the time span. Sedo instructed the seller to push the domain. So obviously Sedo have got a number of registrar accounts, and they had an Enom account. The seller had said to the buyer, if you've got an Enom account, we can push this through really quickly. But the buyer didn't have one, so they chose their preferred registrar. Sedo pushed it through to Enom. The buyer pushed it through to the Sedo Enom account. Next slide, please. Then we can see at that point that the domain had been transferred then to Sedo, the status was okay. The expiration is on the same date, so a year hadn't been added at this stage. Next slide, please. And clearly all the control is now with Sedo, because Sedo has become the registrant now of this domain. Down the bottom, there's a status message, status pending transfer. So that's a sort of a new status message. Next slide, please. At this point, in the buyer's Sedo account, we've got the authorization code. There it's highlighted on the bottom left-hand side. Next slide.
We had a question from Mikey.
Certainly.
Thanks, Chris. This is Mikey for the record. What happens if Sedo goes bankrupt at this exact moment in time? Do they actually own the domain at this point? I'm just curious about this.
Good question. Other than equity law, which we all understand means that the person who's the name holder or the registrant doesn't necessarily mean in absolute law that is the owner. But in practical, so I can't answer that question in that respect, and I don't expect you expecting me to answer it anyway. In practical terms, yes, we do see that the registrant has changed to Seddo, which, as a buyer, I was happy with at the time.
Right.
You know, if you think of from the buyer's side,
yeah.
you know, you're not quite sure what's going to happen, but you do trust Seddo more than the seller.
Yeah.
And things seem to be heading in the right direction.
Right. Thanks.
But there's a question to park there. Authorization code given, that's right. Buyer goes to their domain account with the registrar, Black Knight in this case, puts in the name of the domain, puts in the authorization code, and transfer. Next slide. An important thing in this case is that the registrar, the gaining registrar, did ask, is this domain for yourself? Because actually the registration account with Black Knight is actually my company registration account. And as I said, it's doing it on behalf of a third party. So I was pleased to see the opportunity to pick that next box, next slide, which gave me the opportunity to put in the new Whois details at this point, because I was sort of expecting to have to do that at the end of the process and go through that. But next slide, yes. Actually, there was it did take a long time here. At this point, it did take 6 days for the domain to be transferred over to Black Knight. I did wonder if it would fail and make it a more interesting one and we'd have to go around again. But anyway, at 6 days, which is 1 day outside the site, I'm not quite sure what the delay was. The sales team assured me that everything seemed to be going all right. The DNS is still the same DNS at this point. The status has gone to client transfer prohibited, which is obviously the locked status, which Black Knight do by default, and 1 year has been added to the expiration date. Next slide, please. Yes, the Whois information on the Black Knight Whois has been updated. Next slide, please. Just to show this is what was actually seen on the domain, the dreaded smiling girl. So obviously, for this interim period, although the DNS was the same, still pointing at the old DNS, the vendor must have closed down the hosting, and as I suppose he would do, and allow this default page to show. Next slide, please. Yes. So then. Now that the domain's in Black Knight account going, change the DNS to the correct DNS, the DNS is wanted, and happily within 5 minutes the website was changed. So that was the process. Thank you. That was the process. It went relatively smoothly. Quite a lot of steps. Wouldn't have liked to have tried that if I didn't have some idea of what I was doing. But that's about all to report, really. Any other questions?
Yeah, go ahead, James.
Hi, thanks, Bob. James speaking, and thanks, Chris. I think this is a good use case, and I think you presented it very well. My question is that compared to some of the use cases we saw last week, at any time in this process, although you mentioned that it did take quite a while for some of the steps, but at any time in this process were you unclear on what your next step was or what you were supposed to do next, or was that did you feel like Sato either registrar on either end did a good job of kind of hand-holding from one step to the next, or just what was your overall experience with that?
I suppose my expectations were more or less as, you know, as it happened. I don't think I was handheld to the extent that if I'd been a complete novice. But then there are help facilities. You know, the SEDO, I have to say, the SEDO Transfer Center is very good, and there was other things in the back of that which the contract was uploaded there. An invoice for the sale was uploaded. That was something else that was important. The SEDO process, the escrow process, of course, is different depending on the registrars, which ones we go from. I have known slightly different processes. Maybe if there was a document, you know, an idiot's guide to, or what's the thing, is it for dummies, isn't it? Domain transfers for dummies available somewhere. That would be a nice addition to the knowledge base for transfers. But I think my overall comment would be fine for somebody who's got, you know, my level, who's got reasonable knowledge, but not an expert, but a reasonable knowledge. But I think somebody who had no idea would struggle with it. I mean, I suppose I take business advantage out of that, you know, because I do this for some people, for clients who really don't want to just get involved in this nitty-gritty themselves. And part of it is trusting the SEDO brand. Not quite sure what the next steps were going to be, but they were heading in the right direction, so I was reasonably confident things were... It did take a little while. I mean, the whole process took about 20 days, which was quite a long time. That answered the question. Yeah.
Thanks, Chris. Mikey, did you have a question?
Yeah, this is Mikey for the transcript. Chris, you mentioned something really interesting a minute ago when you said that the contract for the sale was uploaded into the documentation of this process. And I'm curious about other processes like this, because I don't remember seeing a contract upload documentation step in any of the others. And for me, that's a really interesting, important addition to the process, because it goes, in a way, it goes back to the question I asked earlier. You know, if SEDO went poof, presumably there would at least be a contract that was separate from SEDO that could be used to sort out who owned the domain if the thing went dark in the middle. So I'm curious about the two that we've already gone through and the two that are coming up. Do any of those have that contract documentation step in them?
Well, Mikey, Chris speaking again. The original deal, if you like, was agreed just by email, so the contract on that would have been very, very limited. Then the domain was put by the seller into SEDO, so it went with there, and I'm sure we could get examples of SEDO contracts. I'm sure they've got experience in this.
Oh, so this wasn't, sorry to interrupt you, Chris, this wasn't a contract between you and the seller. This was a contract between you and SEDO.
That's right. It's when it's the...
Ah, okay.
The contract, yes, that's automatically generated by virtue of both parties within SEDO. But there is another interesting, to just mention in passing, you're talking about possibility of SEDO going belly up. There's another scenario which I think is more likely that I had experience with, and that's when a domain had been hijacked. And I spotted a little while ago a domain that had partly through my experience on this working group, a domain that had been hijacked because I knew that the owner had got it in the sunrise period. It was actually a government here in Andalusia. And it did transpire. I thought it was strange that it's owned by somebody in Panama. And when I looked at it, it had all the hallmarks of a hijack. That was on Sedo. I contacted Sedo. I contacted all the parties. Sedo locked it. But it did occur to me that had a sale gone through, the contracts with Sedo, you know, Sedo are just an agency, so they're not guaranteeing the ownership of these of the domains. And it would have been a problem had somebody bought it and then the original owner then wave their hand and say, hey, you've got my domain. And that would be a mess. And maybe that's something that we want to also think about. I don't know.
Simonetta wants to make some clear. She's joined us now and wants to make some clarifying statements.
Yes, just on the contract piece, so we're all clear on who are the parties on these contracts. What we do when a sale gets processed through CEDAW, a purchase and sales agreement gets put together between the buyer and the seller. And CEDAW is not a party in the sale. CEDAW is merely a facilitator. So we're made part of this purchase and sales agreement just in with a little phrase that basically says that both parties agree that we're going to help facilitate this. But the contract itself is between the buyer and the seller. It's not showing CEDAW as the seller or the buyer along the chain of this contract at all. So what Mikey was referring to in terms of like having some kind of an agreement between the two parties that is like the legally binding purchase and sales agreement, that's what we have in there. And we're not, CEDAW as an entity is not a party and not the buyer and not the seller in this agreement. What this does, of course, not always work as designed. So in the case that was described by Chris right now, when someone is entering a domain in our marketplace, and basically while you enter it, you have to state that you are the legal owner of this domain name, that it's you're allowed to sell it. There is now, it's not infringing on anyone's rights and all these things. If someone just blatantly ignores all these steps and puts the domain in anyway, we can't always catch this. We have some mechanisms in place to try and catch these cases, but they don't always work. If someone really wants to do something malicious, they'll find ways to do it. But the actual purchase and sales agreement that we put together for any participant in our marketplace is always between the buyer and the seller.
Okay. Thanks, Simonetta. I had my hand up, I guess, during that conversation. This is we moved a little bit past that, but when someone had mentioned the idiot's guide to domain transfer, one of the things that Simonetta and I both commented when we were working on our use cases was the fact that we're both, you know, aftermarket professionals, and yet we found it confusing and hard, and it took a bit of work. So we can only imagine what it would be like for someone who wasn't, familiar with the aftermarket to go through these things. It's definitely a challenge for a mere mortal. So, any other comments on Chris's use case, though, before we move on? Okay. So the next use case was an example of a intra-registrar transfer change of ownership using. Actually, in this case, it's not really escrow. It's more like just being facilitated by Afternic. I've actually asked Rebecca Clifford, who works in our domain transfer team, to walk us through this one. And so, Rebecca, you just want to take us through these slides?
Sure. So there was an agreement to purchase the domain commercialrefrigeration.com, and similar to Sato's process, we have the contract between the buyer and the seller, and Afternic's just working as a facilitator to help assist with the transfer. When the domain enters, once we receive funds here at Afternic, we then reach out to our seller and ask them to assist us in pushing the domain over to Afternic's holding account at the current registrar. In this particular case, it was Domain Discover. So once the seller goes ahead and pushes the domain over to our account, we've already reached out to our buyer to see if they're willing to either, if they either have an account at Domain Discover or if they're willing to create one. facilitate and move the domain over to them at a faster process rather than doing the transfer from one registrar to another. In this particular case, our buyer did create an account at Domain Discover. So what we did is once we received the domain in our holding account, we asked the buyer to provide us with the username for their Domain Discover account, and we initiated a push from our holding account to the buyers. On this particular slide with the Whois, you can see that the registrar is Domain Discover. You can see when the domain is expiring, and when you're pushing from one account to another within the same registrar, typically the lock status doesn't matter. It can be locked or unlocked. We go to the next slide. This slide demonstrates the domain in our Domain Discover holding account. It shows when it's expiring and shows that it's an active domain. We go to the next slide. This is the slide of the Whois information showing that the domain has been moved over to Afternic's Domain Discover holding account, and you can see that Afternic is listed as the administrative contact and the registrant. If we go to the next slide, this is just the process. Each registrar is obviously a little different in how you can move domains. With Domain Discover, they have an easy move domain option that you can click on and select the domains that you'd like to push between one account to another. And on the next slide, we show the domains that are currently in that Domain Discover holding account, and you can see there in yellow, commercialrefrigeration.com. Domain Discover just asks you for the username of the new account that you'd like to push the domain to. You can select the arrows there and then move it over to the selected domains category. We go on to the next slide. You'll see that there's an option to continue forward, and it's just another safety to make sure that you're pushing the correct domain over to the correct account. Next slide. This is just a confirmation. Again, it's another precaution just to make sure that you are moving the correct domain, because once you have pushed it, it's pretty automatic and the domain will move over instantly. So this just confirms that you're moving the correct domain to the correct Domain Discover account. And when you click continue, the domain at that point will automatically move over to the new buyer's account. And then in our particular holding account, we'll receive a confirmation saying that one domain was updated and that it was moved over. It does show the domain is being unlocked here, which it can be locked or unlocked to move it over. And then this slide is showing the domain is now active in the buyer's account, and it shows that active status and the expiration date as well. And then lastly, we show the domain.
We redacted that.
We took out the administrative contact, but it had updated to the new buyer on our end. And it still has the expiration date of the domain, and I believe there was another slide that showed when the domain was last updated, which is this final slide here. And it shows that it was updated that same day and the time in which we pushed it over.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Becca. Anybody have any questions on this use case? No? Is everybody still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Just got awfully quiet. All right. Thanks, Becca. This is Bob speaking again. All right. So if there are no questions on that one, we will move to use case number five. The example here is a inter-register transfer, should be inter-registrar transfer from register.com to Network Solutions without a change of ownership. This one was done by Jonathan Tenenbaum. So, Jonathan, would you mind walking us through this one?
Sure. Yeah, and this one's probably one of the more simple ones in that there is no change of ownership. So we probably touched on a lot of the pieces of the process, but obviously it's I'd be glad to go through it. Now how do I move the slides along? Well, okay.
Actually, this is Bob. I'll do that for you, Jonathan. Just say next slide when you're ready for me to move on.
Okay, great. So here's the process flow. And Bob, I appreciate you putting this together. This is definitely helpful. And I'll just kind of run through it and briefly. Basically in this case, it's even though it says seller and buyer, they're effectively the same person. moving the domain name from one registrar to another. And in this case, the steps are that the registrant unlocks the name as a losing registrar, requests the auth code from the losing registrar, then goes to the gaining registrar, creates an account, initiates the transfer, enters the auth code, basically chooses how long they want their registration for, enters payment information, and gets the confirmation, confirms that the transfer on their end from the gaining registrar, and then basically the transfer is complete. It's a relatively simple process. Next slide, please. And again, this is kind of just sort of the bullet points of the same process flow. This is the pre-transfer whois info. The key piece there, just that the sponsoring registrar in that case is the losing registrar where the domain is starting. Next slide. Now, as I said, the unlocking of the domain name, in this case, the registrant goes onto their account management tool with the losing registrar, which in this case is register.com. So they basically go into their to the interface and they click to unlock the domain name. Next slide. And then once that's done and they've disabled the domain lock, they'll request the auth code. Next slide. And then once they do that, once they've requested the auth code, they'll go to the gaining registrar. In this case, it's Network Solutions, and this is just the home page where they'll look to there's the transfer tools right there where they'll look to initiate the transfer. Next slide. They'll input the domain name that they're looking to transfer. Next slide. And then there's we have the steps available there, which, you know, to provide some assistance to the registrant in transferring the domain name, and then making sure that it's eligible and everything else. Next slide. Then they'll be requested to input the auth code, which they had previously requested. I probably should have done a few more of the. I mean, you guys really, really got under the hood, and I apologize if I kind of. I mean, could have thrown in a few more slides, for example, the when they got the auth code and that kind of thing. And this is a little bit more of sort of a broad strokes of the process. At that point, they input the auth code. It pops up, and they plug it in. Next slide. And then at that point, it's up to them to determine and how long they want to register the domain name with the gaining registrar. In this case, you know, they can pick, you know, the different options up to the 10 years. Next slide. This is just a little bit of some additional info related to the account creation. Just mentioning that it's either the individual or the company, and the administrator is either the registrant themselves, if it's an individual, or the representative of the business. Then they go through the account creation process, name, address, and all that stuff, the login info, security question. Next slide. Next slide. And then, most importantly, they plug in their payment info, which is a process similar that I'm sure everyone's gone through one way or another. Plug in the info, then they get a order confirmation. Oh, sorry, one more, Bob. And then they get their order confirmation, and then at that point they get a confirmation email. Let's jump ahead. Again, this is just a little bit more color to the process, just that the gaining registrar must then email the administrative contact to prove and confirm the transfer. Once the registrant gets that confirmation email, they click on the link to approve the transfer, and then this is just the next slide is that confirmation email that they receive with the click through, and then they get to the confirmation page and confirm that the transfer. And then when we look at the final slide here, the post transfer whois info, the sponsoring registrar now is Network Solutions, the gaining registrar in this case, And that is what made this a little, not even tricky, but the billing organization and stuff like that is still register.com. So like when you look at the pre and post, but when you, the sponsoring transfers, the obviously, as everyone knows, is the key field in this instance, and that it displays the gaining registrar. So at that point, that's the process. So.
Hey, great. This is Bob. Thanks very much, Jonathan. Does anyone have any questions, comments, or otherwise on use case number 5? No? Okay, great. Well, I guess yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no. I said sweet when there were no questions.
Okay.
I was off the hook.
I guess the open items on the use case document would be we have some title descriptions to change on use case number 3, on use case number 5, one more flowchart to do, and then we'll wrap that up. So I should be able to get those wrapped up by the end of the day today or tomorrow latest. Marika, I'll put those up on the Dropbox and then for archival or posting wherever the appropriate place is.
Okay.
Bob, this is James.
Yep, go ahead, James.
Simonetta and I were just pointing out that I think there's still a few slides that have some information that folks may not want in the permanent record.
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't see the chat.
I think it's use case 3 and use case 5. So I don't know if we can enlist staff's help on that or if you still have control over it where you can just black out those fields.
Yeah, I can absolutely do that. Do you want to just it might be easiest if you just want to pop me a note offline. Just give me the slide numbers, and I'll take care of that before I upload it.
Sure. I'll take a look.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so I'll just turn back over to James or Marika.
Okay, thanks, Bob. And thanks to Chris and Rebecca. And Jonathan, did I miss anyone? Okay, really appreciate you putting together all of these use cases in this presentation. I think it was very informative, and I hope that once we get it uploaded, we'll be referring back to that over the lifespan of this PDP. And I hope that all of us now have a better flavor for all of the different ways that change of control is currently affected in GTLDs. I think the right answer is it's kind of all over the map. But I think that was a really great exercise, and I really appreciate you putting all that together, everyone who worked on that over the holidays. Okay, so can we then circle back to agenda item number 2, which was, if you recall our last meeting and previous meetings when we set up a work plan, we had a block of Tuesdays where we were just kind of allotting that we would do a more fine-grained work plan once we got to those points. And we have arrived at such a point in our work plan, and Avery has very graciously put together a draft detailed work plan for this meeting and running through March 6th. So if we could, I see Marika now has that up in the Adobe chat room. If we could then perhaps spend a few minutes discussing what she has listed here and if we spot any significant omissions or perhaps something that we need to spend a little bit more or a little bit less time on. I'll go ahead and kick us off here with just the observation that we've received very little in the way of public comment and constituency or stakeholder group statements. So, you know, whatever time we have allotted for review of those may not be as burdensome as we originally planned. Perhaps at this point, Avery, if you don't mind, could you perhaps walk us through beginning at January 10th what your thoughts would be for the detailed work plan?
Sure. Thanks. And just to say that this is a first stab in the dark, and I'm not even taking any bets on whether I picked the right thing. but just something to throw stones at. So, yeah,
understood.
I did put
thanks.
In, excuse me?
I just said understood, and thanks for getting us started.
Okay. So, basically, okay, so really starting at the next meeting was the review of the public comments. And, yeah, I did basically allow for, I guess it was 1, 2, 3 weeks of comments from public to, and so starting the review of the public comments next week, I understand that there aren't many. Then the following meeting would have been to finish that if there was any open conversation. And in the review of the public comments, I wasn't thinking that we were just reading them, but depending on how deep they go, it was actually discussing and actually thinking about how one would approach them. Does that change our, you know, overall work ideas at all? Does that change any of those, you know, diagrams and maps that Mikey's been putting together, et cetera? So that was all part of that. Then, but basically, so if that was a 1 week, possibly extending into a second, but certainly it didn't look like it would be more than an hour to an hour and a half worth of discussion. Then beginning with the stakeholder group constituency, at this point we don't know that there's more than one. For example, I don't know whether my stakeholder group or any of the constituencies within it is going to. I know I've been bugging them, and I assume the rest of you have been talking to yours, whether it's, you know, the commercial side of non-contracted, or, you know, whether the registrars themselves plan to make any comments. We've heard that the registry, so that we don't know. At this point, though, on the assumption that, again, there wasn't going to be a lot, it allots somewhere around an hour to an hour and a half. It looks like a lot when you say it's a week, but basically we're talking about an hour to an hour and a half, maybe slightly longer, and going into then a discussion of any ACSO comments we get. Again, I don't know whether at large ALAC is going to. I know I've spoken to them a bit about whether they were going to, but I don't know. And so basically it comes down to then basically a three-week period, three-hour period, where we're reviewing the various other three kinds of comments, understanding that at some point that they may need reviews. If anything substantive comes in from CCNSO at large, or who knows, GAC, although I am not holding my breath, you know, those would need responses. They might need further clarification. So, okay, so then that was that. At that point, we're at the end of January. I put in a marker that we should stop then, having looked at the comments, having our initial mind map of the issues, and then basically look at, well, what do we need to do in Costa Rica? Are we just having a face-to-face meeting with a program? Do we have open issues that we want to have a more public meeting that we discuss those with, et cetera? So that block then. And then look at, and this is where I took a stab in the dark, and this reflects my prejudices in the world as opposed to perhaps James's. So definitely a point for contention. I tend to, if we've got easy tasks and hard tasks, I tend to want to put the hard tasks first and leave the so-called low-hanging fruit for later, because really the analogy to a tree doesn't work. The fruit's not going to drop and rot. So therefore, we really don't have to pick it right away, and I think of getting the hard, and it looks like issue A is the harder, more encompassing one. At least if I look at the mind map, it certainly had a greater degree of issues to be discussed. So basically, at that point, we've gone through our comments. Now we start and look at issue A, We spend a little bit of time at the end of January after we've talked about our program for C and sort of say, okay, how do we want to structure the work of A? And perhaps that calls for another update to the work plan. I don't know. If we're submitting any documents, and then the following week, submitting any documents for Costa Rica, they need to get out then, so that's the last week. For that, we may not have documents, you know, but so that's why I said, if any. And then basically an undifferentiated, you know, 4 hours of, 3 to 4 hours of item A with going back and looking at issues reports in terms of those to make sure that we've got that fresh in our mind. It should just be a quick review, and then getting into discussion as we've rated it. Now, of course, this could be issue B or this could be issue C, a different approach. The low-hanging fruit approach would be to say, well, C, we should be able to get that completely knocked off in 2-3 hours, so why don't we take C first, make sure that we've just dealt with that and everything implied, and then move on. And those are, you know, options for the group. As I say, I went with my prejudice of start with hard and leave the ones that look like easy later. And, in fact, what you may find is that you've just evolved a decision to the B, the C, so you get to the end of it and say, so, yeah, we're going to use that you know, standard IAN identifier, right? Yeah, okay, sure, yeah, that's the presumption we've made, and the decision's already done. Anyway, that's the first stab at it, you know. No pride of ownership in having set it out that way, so please throw rocks at it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Avery. I went ahead and put myself in the queue just to kind of add to, I think, a lot of what you said. I think this is an excellent start, and I think that we're probably not going to... it's probably going to survive mostly intact. I just wanted to point out that, yes, I tend to agree that we should do the hard ones first and come back and do the easy questions, particularly in this case where we found that there may be a dependency in issue B that we didn't notice. I think the caution is that we did that with the previous iteration, IRTPB, and we spent so much time on the one hard question that we really felt like we didn't do some of the smaller questions justice. So I think if we do have an opportunity to knock item C out once we review the constituency statements and the comments, I think that we should probably not miss that opportunity because circling back at the 11th hour, it just feels rushed. I don't know if that's just my opinion. I think the one thing that we may want to add, just off the cuff here, is that if we don't use all of our review time for public comments and constituency statements, we might want to then move the discussion from item A, add another session for that, or maybe half a session, including some brief review of the approach mind map that Mikey put together that we all worked on. So just so we can kind of have that as a touchstone that we can go back to and say, yes, this is what we agreed on initially, so we would how we would approach this. And that would kind of set the stage for tackling issue A. I noticed that January 31st is listed twice here, so
cool.
But they have different things, so we may have an extra week that we don't really have.
Okay.
And otherwise, throw it open to, well, I see Marika's got a question, and we'll throw it open to the queue. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Mark. I just wanted to give an update on the statements possibly by other ACs and SOs because I did reach out to the different staff members that are supporting these different groups that we send a notice to. And just for your information, the CC and SO actually had a bit of delay in getting that out to their members. So they actually send out the notice today to their members and have given everyone 2 weeks to respond. And I think they've actually encouraged CCTLDs just to directly respond to the working group or, you know, via staff. So so there we will have to wait probably 2 weeks to see if we get anything or not. From the ESSEC, I've understood that the notice was also sent to the ESSEC mailing list, but no further feedback was received as of this moment. So at this stage, I think it's unlikely that we will get anything further there. I'm still waiting to hear from my colleagues that are supporting the GAC and the ALAC, whether there's anything we should be looking forward to or not. So hopefully I'll have an update on that at the next call, and I guess I could feed them as well into the work plan if further comments are received or not.
Okay, thanks. The CCNSO in particular is important that we get some kind of feedback from them if they're able to offer it. So we should definitely leave the door open for SOs and ACs as long as they need it, within reason. If they need an extra week or two, we can add them to the end of our review. You know, other than some of that just minor feedback on my part, removing the duplicate for 31st and perhaps sharing one of the sessions with before we dive into issue A, just a review of the approach. Anyone else see any significant changes they'd like to offer for this particular work plan? Or should we call it, pencil it in and say this is how we're going to spend the next month and a half? Of course, there's still opportunities to chime in on the list if you want to take a little bit more time to digest it. But overall, I think Audrey's done a fantastic job here, and it's airtight. Okay, thanks, everyone. We've got about 5 more minutes.
Okay, just the last point.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, I've made the changes. I'll send out an updated copy of it. And of course, this is just a working thing, but thanks. And I can't believe I didn't notice we had 2/31st of January.
It must have been like that on the original.
Oh yeah, no, I didn't add a row, as far as I know. So.
Okay, Bob, you're up.
Yeah, thanks, James. This is Bob. I know it seems like it's far away, but one thing, if it would be possible to book the time for the face-to-face meeting and, you know, give us as much advance notice on that as possible, I think it is for everybody. We all have lots of meetings. So if we could block that out ahead of time just to make sure we can schedule it, that would be great.
Absolutely, totally, emphatically agree. Maybe we should, Marika, if you can come to the next call or perhaps even on the list and let us know what our available days and times are. I think we want to stay away from the weekend prior, which is the GNSO session. I think we want to stay away from Tuesdays, which is when everybody's with their constituencies and stakeholder groups. But if you can give us some options, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, that would be fantastic. Marika, did you want to?
Yeah, this is Marika. To a certain extent, it depends a little bit as well whether the working group is looking for a face-to-face meeting and just the working group itself, or whether it's going to be an outreach meeting. Because if there's much more flexibility if it's just a working group meeting, because it's just trying to find some time, you know, that works for the members of the group. And often, you know, we tend to lean into maybe morning sessions, breakfast meetings, so then, you know, the rest of the meeting hasn't started. But if it would be more of a workshop, an open session, then the typical days for having those are either Wednesday morning or Thursday morning, provided that there are no big changes to the schedule, because we usually have certain sessions with which we cannot or don't want to conflict, because it will, you know, draw away the people that we're trying to target. So for a public workshop, typically Wednesday mornings and I believe Thursday mornings are the normal times that work best. So.
Okay, thanks, Marika. Let's maybe put that out onto the list. I mean, personally, I have an opinion that with our aggressive and compressed work schedule that we are going to need both a face-to-face meeting and possibly a outreach session where we at least give the folks in the community have strong feelings on this an opportunity to come and throw rocks at us. Although that may not be all that interesting or valuable until we have something on paper, like, for example, for Prague. So, you know, maybe we can just put that out on the list and see what the members, especially those who are not able to attend, might think. But, you know, even if an outreach session is saying to the community, hey, we're here, here's our group, here's our charter that we're looking at, here's what we're trying to tackle, and here's some of the feedback we've received thus far, I think that there's probably, you know, at a minimum, setting aside an hour to do that is probably a good investment in future feedback. Simonetic, go ahead.
I think what would be really nice to get at this meeting is basically just a collection of issues that people have with the process. because that doesn't yet give you a solution or anything, but it gives you a flavor and a feel for what are people thinking. And just basically this collection of problems is not something that people like to put in a written statement to another work group, but it might be something really helpful for us to have if we just ask this question in an in-person meeting in Costa Rica.
I agree, Simonetta. I think that we've seen where people may be reluctant to or may not have the time to submit a formal statement, have no problem stepping up to a microphone and, let's say, sharing. So good catch there. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. In that context, the working group might also want to consider whether it then will be more effective to actually go out to some of those key groups that you want to hear from. I presume one of them might be the CCNSO, the other one might be the registrars, and actually request time on their schedule to come and talk to them. Because what we often see is that it's very difficult to get people to these workshops because there are many competing issues going on, and they don't always know what is exactly, on the agenda or what is expected from them. So either we need to do some really specific targeted outreach to make sure that those people come to our meeting, or otherwise maybe consider going to those meetings to those groups that we really want to hear from and really, put it on their agenda and try to get the discussion going in that way.
Right. Thanks, Marika. Okay, Aubrey, and then we'll probably close off the discussion for here. So,
yes,
Aubrey, go ahead.
Just quickly, I really do want to endorse the idea of trying to meet with the CCNSO. And that's probably a decision that if we're going to make it, we should make it now, because I expect that now was probably a good time to ask for a chunk of their time. Thanks.
Okay, excellent. So meeting with them specifically in a closed session outside of...
Basically,
okay.
There's specific information that we say we want from the CCNSO. And or at least we wanted to have a specific discussion about some of the processes and procedures they use. So in that one particular case, it seems like we could already make a decision within this group that, yeah, that seems like a good thing to do, and perhaps we want to request a time to meet with them in their technical work day. And, of course, I don't know if that's the same day as Constituency Day. I don't think it is, but to try and get a session in there. And if we did want to do that, I would think the earlier we ask them, the better.
Okay, sounds good. So it sounds like we're talking about three separate sessions here, or possibly the opportunity to combine, which is a
public outreach session,
face-to-face working group session, and then a specific session where we draft some particular questions to the CCNSO. And I think maybe, Marika, you and I can work offline to see if there's some opportunities where we can compress or bundle some of those functions together so that we don't take more than our fair share of the slice of the calendar in Costa Rica. Okay, well, thanks, everyone. I did want to close it off for here. I think it was a very good session, and look forward to next week. And just as a reminder, I will be traveling. I think Bill has also issued his apologies. We'll be traveling, so the call will be led by Aubrey, and I will join as I can. So thanks, everyone, and have a great afternoon or evening.
Thanks, James.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tim. You may now stop the recording.